Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick filling in for John Hockenberry today. President Barack Obama continues a 10-day trip today. He kicked off his Asia swing in his home state of Hawaii, advocating for land and ocean conservation.
No nation, not even one as powerful as the United States, is immune from a changing climate. I saw it myself last year in our northernmost state of Alaska, where the sea is already swallowing villages and eating away at shorelines, where the permafrost thaws and the tundra is burning, where glaciers are melting at a pace unprecedented in modern times. And it was a preview of our future if the climate keeps changing faster than our efforts to address it.
Now, President Obama's trip culminates at the G20 summit in Hangzhou, China, on September 4th. Before the summit, President Obama meets with China's President Xi Jinping tomorrow. It's expected that both the U.S. and China will cement their commitments to the Paris Global Climate Agreement from last year. Now, President Obama wants this climate deal to be a key part of his legacy as his presidency winds down. The truth is that we can't do it without the Chinese. David Biello is here. He's science curator for TED Talks and is a contributing editor to Scientific American. David, thanks for being here.
No problem.
Well, how important is it now for the United States and China to ratify the Paris Agreement? Why does that count right now?
It's extremely important because they are the two largest polluters in the world. If China and the U.S. don't act, then it doesn't really matter what anybody else does. We're responsible for roughly 40% of global pollution causing climate change.
And also in terms of the actual dynamics of the agreement, that there are triggers here, like the largest polluters have to agree before the whole thing kicks in, right?
Correct. 55 countries representing 55% of global pollution have to agree to the agreement before it can take force. Obviously, we'd be a long way there if 40% of global emissions from these two countries kicked in.
So the two largest polluters, there's the rules of the agreement itself. Is it fair to call this sort of the starting gun, really, to the practical application of Paris?
I think that's extremely fair to say. So far, the ratifiers have been smaller countries, those who are on the front lines of a changing climate, like small island states. These would be the first big countries to sign on. And interestingly enough, in recent days, India also signaled its willingness to sign on to its Paris commitments.
Another large polluter along with the U.S. and China. So what's left to be done in the Paris Agreement that's not accomplished? There was a great deal when this was widely reported by us and everybody else, a lot of discussion about what this agreement can accomplish, but also how it fell short. It wasn't enforceable. It was basically enforceable by a public shame factor that if you were a polluter, other countries would know it and you would be sort of shamed into action. So what's left to be done on the practical side to get agreements like the one we may see this week into major reductions?
It's to actually do it. So the U.S. is about halfway to its goal of at least a 26% drop in pollution by 2025. Good news from China is that their emissions may have peaked, but they have promised, assuming they agree, to peak their pollution by 2030. The practical steps are actually implementing those moves. Now, yes, they are not enough on their own to halt climate change in its tracks, but they are the first steps that we're making as a global community to restrain climate change pollution.
And how far has China gone to actually cut? They've made several agreements. They seem to be changing policy to adapt to climate change, but they've been rapidly growing, of course, their population, but also building coal-fired power plants still at an alarming clip when you look at the statistics.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But they are burning less coal, which is the most important thing. So these new coal-fired power plants that they're building are actually more efficient than the many smaller, less efficient coal-fired power plants that they used to have. They're also building more nuclear power plants than anybody else. They're building more wind farms than anybody else. And they're building more solar panels than anybody else. Now, China relies on coal, and getting them off the coal habit is kind of the whole thing with climate change.
And they're buying a lot more cars than they used to.
Exactly.
Which is also important, although not as important as what they call the point source. The power plants are the big sources, right?
Exactly. Coal-fired power plants are the number one source all around the world.
So countries have agreed to this. President Obama goes to China, high-profile handshake with the president there. there is a factor here in the United States' future, which is that Donald Trump could get elected president. Now, if you're the Chinese and you're making this agreement with the United States at this point, how do you view the potential that one of the candidates says they would tear up these agreements and renegotiate? How does that go into the calculation?
I think the Chinese are going to do what they want to do, regardless of who our president is. And the Chinese want to cut pollution for their own health, frankly. Combating climate change is going to help reduce the haze and smog that they're coping with. And it really is a huge public health threat in China. It is a social security threat for the Communist Party. They want to retain power. This is one of the main threats to their power. They're going to act on climate change regardless of what we do. However, if we give them an excuse to kind of lay back or go slower, they probably will take that.
Because both of these countries do that. I mean, you hear in this country all the time, it's not worth us taking risks for our economy if the Chinese aren't following suit, if the Indians aren't following suit.
Exactly. And it's the same over there.
China has a terrible particulate pollution problem, which is separate from carbon and climate change. But you're saying that these two things kind of go hand in hand.
The two things go hand in hand because that particulate problem comes from those same coal-fired power plants.
So you reduce one, you reduce the other.
Exactly.
Sort of two for one. So how important is this, though, in the overall U.S.-China relationship? These relationships are complicated and multifactorial. They have parallel tracks. We all know that. But we're seeing other tracks where there are major disagreements between the U.S. and China. China's militarization of the South China Sea is a major flashpoint. So we're cooperating in this area, and I wonder how that helps in the overall relationship.
Well, I think this is one of the few areas where the U.S. and China, at least currently, completely agree. We both want to act on climate change, and that helps build goodwill and friendship between the two countries. And the truth is, if we both act on climate change, we're a long way towards solving the problem.
And for the desire for President Obama to have this as a major part of his legacy, I mean, how long into the future before the historians are writing about this will we have to go to know if this really was a positive part of his legacy, if it worked out to mean anything?
I think we'll find out in about 2025.
That long?
Yeah. That's when we'll know whether the U.S. hit its targets. You know, Barack Obama failed to pass climate legislation early in his presidency. This is his chance to make some of that ground back.
President Obama on a final swing visiting China. He's there for the G20 summit, also to cement a major climate agreement between China and the United States. David Biello, science curator for TED Talks, contributing editor for Scientific American. Thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.